Hey folks, good morning and welcome. This is a little bit different than usual. If you're watching this on the Facebook live stream, you can see that it's different. There's this table in front of me, not the norm. The camera's pointed somewhere different. You know, a couple of visual changes. If you're listening on the podcast, none of that may be relevant, but just want you to know we're doing something a little different today. And also, if you are in either sort of media, whether you're watching on Facebook or whether you're listening to the podcast, this is also a little different in the sense that it was not live. It was pre-recorded because although I'm available this Sunday, I will be in a location where I'm not 100% confident that the internet would support a live stream. And so I thought better safe than sorry as far as making sure things were where they should be when they should be. Anyway, welcome. It's good to be with you. It's good to be with you right here, right now, in this place, on this part of the continent, on this land, on Treaty One land, where we are made welcome by the peoples that inhabited this land way before any of us who have European ancestry or settler ancestry, way before the people from whom we are descendants arrived in this land with their ideas and their agenda. And I think that's important, not just to check a box, at least for me, but to bring me back each week, and in different ways every day, but in this way, each week when we gather, to bring me back to that part of the story and to the recognition that stories change over time. They get twisted and or not told. Things get left untold because the tellers have agendas of their own. And recovering the truth about old stories is a lot of work, but it's also the way in which those stories offer us their fuller gifts, including the story of the treaties, of these agreements that were made and not honored, and toward which we now turn ourselves in the interest of seeking truth and building reconciliation. So, glad we can gather, glad we're made welcome, grateful for this place. Let's just take a few moments and breathe together. Again, this week, let's do as we did a couple of weeks ago, and you breathe however you wish. If you want to guide through that, if that helps to just sort of release the your mind from having to pay attention to thinking about what you're doing, I will use my favorite practice for this time slot, which is square breathing. So I'll be breathing in through my nose for a count of three, so I'm filled right up deep down with the breath of life, and I will cradle that breath as the precious thing, the not promised but precious thing that it is, for a count of three, and then I will exhale for a count of six, because that's what empties me right out. And I will do that four times, and that will help me to make the part of my brain that yammers away about the details and reacts to things, it'll help it settle down, be calm, be still, and free up my thoughtful brain, my executive functions, my higher functions, if you will, to consider the things we're exploring and to consider you and us together and hold consciously things like gratitude for land and welcome and that sort of stuff. So lots of reasons to do this. All right, let's take a moment and breathe together and then we'll go exploring. Here we go. Peace, everybody. Thank you. So we've been on this exploration about doubt and faith, and although I haven't used this language explicitly before, in some ways, we've been on this exploration about growing up. I've found that that's one of the most useful ongoing metaphors for me in trying to understand or illustrate spiritual change over time, is the ways in which we learn other sorts of lessons over time. Our journey through physical, mental, emotional, social development, it doesn't always offer just illustrative possibilities when it comes to our spiritual journeys. In many instances, those realms, if you want, that I mentioned, physical, social, spiritual, emotional, those realms move, if not in tandem with spiritual movements, then certainly in ways that have real connection to those spiritual movements. So, for example, the utter dependency and egocentricity of infancy is both an insightful illustration of where we begin any spiritual journey, and it's also a true telling of what it's like to start developmentally as a human baby. And this need to be taught a meaningful moral framework for the world around us as we move out of infancy into childhood and begin our equipping for independence is also a good match for stage one's dominant value, which is simplicity, as we explored last week. And then there's the natural restlessness of adolescence and early adulthood where, you know, we start to challenge authority. We have this growing inclination to learn how to really get things done in the world. Those kinds of inclinations developmentally can help us understand some of the key movements into the key value of complexity in stage two, you know, which we will explore more as we go, and so on. So we'll keep working with many of those sorts of metaphors and illustrations as we go. They work, they're helpful, but before we really dig into stage two, I wanted to take a little detour into another metaphor for the whole process, because we need another one, right? Good things come in threes. So we've got this schema of stages, and that stages can help us see the way in which each area of growth builds on the previous area of growth. You know, that's sort of the picture of stages. And then we've also explored a little bit this metaphor of rings on a tree, and with the hope that that might help us to imagine both sequence, the way things come after one another, but also interdependence, how the ways we change build on what has gone before, but they also depend on what has gone before. So, interdependence. And then what I want to explore today is a visual metaphor. It sort of gets ahead of the curve of where we're at in the stages schema, but I wanted to do it at this point in the process in part because when we get into stages two and following, things get a little more chaotic. And I don't mean they'll necessarily get more chaotic for us as explorers, but the features of those stages are not as not quite as tidy. More on that shortly. So stage zero just is, as we've discussed, right? The complete self-centeredness and dependence of stage zero doesn't make room for change, or at least not for self-aware or self-conscious change. And as a result, that stage also doesn't have any room for doubt. Stage one is developmentally necessary if we're not going to stay stuck in infancy, right? So most of us turn the corner and we enter stage one. And because stage one is so much about things like authority and certainty, it's a stage that also mostly feels quite orderly. It's simple, it's tidy, things tend to be in straight rows. When we encounter something that doesn't want to line up, we ask an authority figure how to make sense of it, and they help us to do that, and we put it into its place, and things are tidy again, right? So all in order. Now, if that feels too simplistic for you, and to some it might, and to some it might not, and that's all to the good, but if that feels too simplistic for you, or like I just did something really reductionist there, just think about how many big human conundrums you have heard explained in religious settings as being a result of the fall. Wondering about existence of evil in the world? Good God, evil? Big problem. So big it has its own theological name. Oh, that's the fall. Zunk. Everything just lines up. Oh, there's the explanation, right? So that's kind of how that works. But in stage one, we might have big mysteries, but what we have more dominantly is tidy, systemic answers. So mostly things in stage one are orderly. But when that stops working for us, when we start to doubt it for whatever reason or reasons, one of the first experiences we often have is that the world starts to feel, not so orderly. And it's as if how we found our way through the things that really baffle us or knock us for a loop, the mechanism we use, the kinds of systems we use to get through those things, stop working. And we're tossed into a different universe, one where it's not easy to find your way home when you feel like you're facing something unfamiliar. Not a nice feeling place to be. And in a space like that, it can be hard to stay hopeful. And hope is what keeps us moving forward. So one way to think about this dilemma is to consider what we're hoping for. Or to put it another way, if it's forward movement we're looking for, what do we imagine we're moving toward? What's the goal? And on this, I want to, a couple of different ideas here. If you're an engines kind of person, as in car engines, what's the fuel? What's the fuel for the engine of hope? Especially when we've been taught it's things like right belief or certainty, and then we find out we can't really believe in either one of those things. How do we handle that? Without some entry points into questions like these, it can be pretty hard to keep moving when things get chaotic or disordered. So, what I want to offer us today is what I experience as a forward-facing metaphor, an image that helps me to keep hope in view when my systems are failing or when I'm in a fold-out freefall, which honestly happens fairly often, or at least often enough that I've learned, you know, it's familiar, I've learned not to panic, and sometimes even to enjoy the ride because it tends to carry me to, you know, good places in the end, but you got to kind of trust the process a bit. So as with the stages schema, the core idea here is not original to me. Generally credited, at least in the form that I'm going to use it today, to Richard Rohr, who is a familiar figure to many of you. Not hard to look up if he's not. I'm not going to be following his application of this metaphor all that directly. So if it feels kind of familiar but not quite familiar, then that's probably why. So if you prefer musical illustrations, this is a riff on my riff on Richard's melody. All right, let me try to put that all into one sentence. My hope is that this illustration that I'm about to lay out for us can help make growth through the stages less traumatic, less accidental, more natural, and more intentional. That's what I'm hoping for. In a word, my hope is that it can make it better. All right, so the launching point for this comes from a book that I read a long time ago, a book written by a guy named Stephen Covey. The book is called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And there was a franchise that rolled out of that, 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens. I sort of stepped away when it started to feel a little too chicken soup for the soul-y, but that first book of Covey's, it's still a gem. And I would say that I was pretty firmly a stage 2 person in terms of my own spiritual development when I read that book. And although we haven't considered that stage in any detail yet together, one of the high values of stage 2 is efficiency or effectiveness. How do you get things done? Purposeful things. How do you make the most of your life? And so I read the book because that's the stage I was in. I read it from that vantage point, and I really learned a lot about setting priorities and all of that stuff, you know, being highly effective. I still use Covey's quadrants regularly in my thinking about what matters most. So what I've realized since then, though, is that the idea at the core of the book is really much more of a stage 4 idea. And again, this will have some more layers to it when we get to that stage and we unpack it. But at the heart of Covey's book is basically this mantra, this idea that if we're going to be effective, we need to begin with the end in mind. Begin with the end in mind. Where are we headed in the end? And to really skip ahead of our staged explorations at this point, I'm just going to give away the end goal of the whole process of moving through the stages. Just going to save you months. I don't think we're going to take that long. Anyway, you can just cut to the chase in terms of ideas here right now. So our goal, the end that's in mind for this whole stages process, is finding a way to express our spirituality, our faith, if you want to use that kind of language for spirituality. The end goal is finding a way to express our spirituality as love. That's where we're headed. That's the end goal. And I'm not going to expand on that now. I think it'll be more helpful to revisit it after we've made the journey through the process together. But just so you know, that's the end that I have in mind and that model has in mind. For now, I hope we can just work with that as it is. The end goal is a spirituality that expresses itself as love. All right? All right. When we're wee ones, when we're the littles, spiritually and otherwise, if we're loved, then that's all good. As we move from stage 0 into stage 1, we're often taught that what keeps the love coming, what keeps us experiencing love, is keeping the rules, holding the right beliefs, keeping the house in order, and not allowing doubt to creep in and mess with things. And sometimes we can even make the move into stage two and still keep things relatively orderly, as long as we stay focused on taking the steps to success that build on the orderly doctrines or ideas that we were taught in stage one. So let's think about that part of our life experience as belonging in a particular box, in a particular realm. And that box, I'm gonna say that box is called order. Okay, so that's this little guy right here. Order. Right? So that's stage one. Stage zero. Before the box. I don't know. Now, we can stay inside that stage one box our entire lives. Lots of people do. There's lots of people who never even kind of bump against the lid. They like it there. It's a pretty nice box, especially if nothing happens that is sufficient to mess with the orderliness. Or if something like that does happen, we don't look for a way out, but we look for a way deeper in. We try to find a way to move more toward the center of that stage one box, of that experience of orderliness and simplicity. But for some of us, things happen that mess with that, right? And they often involve considerable pain. That's not unusual. And they also sometimes come wrapped in big, messy versions of love. I don't know if you've ever thought about disorder that way, or the things that shake us up, but love isn't always tidy, right? Lots of times we use a word like love and we just think, oh, that's sort of the warm, fuzzy, everything is good, the rom-com, happy ending, no more challenges after the credits roll, right? Like, it's just, we're good. We found whatever love is like, and that's how it's going to be. That moment of finding is how it's going to be forever. But most of us have lived long enough to know that that's simplistic. That's not simple. That's simplistic. And sometimes love is messy and confounding. And not the least of the aspects of love that can be messy and confounding is learning how to love ourselves and stop doing the things that sabotage ourselves and sabotage our relationships with other people. So sometimes it comes in love. Love can mess things up. Which seems like a funny thing to say, but as I've sort of talked about it, I hope that makes sense. And it's not unusual for things that mess with that simplicity and that order to show up because of other life experiences that we sometimes are fortunate to enjoy. Things like cross-cultural travel, whether that's geographic or otherwise, we're in a multicultural country, we might have a cross-cultural experience that profoundly impacts us right here in this city. If you grew up in sort of the stage one version of Christianity, and you went to school and you made a Muslim friend, and they turned out to be a more beautiful person than some of your Christian friends, you know, the ones with the right beliefs, that kind of an experience can just be like, whoa, 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 what's happening to the orderliness of my stage one moral framework? Them and us. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. But wait a minute, this bad guy's a good guy. Poof, right? So that can happen. Cross-cultural travel or experiences. Also, another thing that tends to shake up that stage one tidiness is good education, by which I mean education that encourages us to think for ourselves, to not be afraid to question the status quo. Education that reveals more layers to the systems that we were taught were complete. You know, I've sometimes used the phrase at the table, the things they didn't teach you in Sunday school. Those layers. Right? However it happens, this box, order, starts to feel way too small. And we start to find ourselves like banging into the lid of it. We're crunching into the sides of it. We're bouncing around in there in ways that make our heads hurt and that make our hearts hurt. And we start to look for a way out. So we break out of that childhood box of order into a bigger box labeled disorder, right? We break into this one. Now, what we find in the disorder box is more room for our questions, more room for exploration. This is a box in which we can deconstruct our inherited assumptions and beliefs. We can be suspicious of authority figures and institutions.
We can subject every belief or every truth claim to deep scrutiny. We can doubt everything and anything we want to in the disorder box. And as we'll see later in this series, this is all important work that tends to belong mostly to stage three. We kind of might start into it in stage two, but we really go crazy on it in stage three. Looking around at the table, if we were using this boxes metaphor, I would say that there are a lot of us at the table that are living in this box, the box of disorder, and feeling reasonably at home there. It's possible with this box, as with the others, to stay here. Some people stay here because it just feels like home. That disordered experience, not especially distressing for them. In fact, they often experience it as liberating, and it continues to feel liberating, and they just stay right there in stage three. And some folks stay here because when they get restless here, for reasons that some of you know personally, but we haven't talked about yet in this series, when some people get restless in the disorder box, they don't go anywhere because no one has yet shown them a bigger box to move to. And so that's the restlessness is there, but the understanding of what might come next is not. And so they stay. But sometimes when we're finding the box of disorder starting to feel like its own sort of prison, so it's bigger than the previous box, but it's still confining, when we start to have that kind of an experience, we might start to wonder if there might be a way to put all those experiences of disorder and deconstruction into some kind of meaningful reconstruction. Not a return to certainty and simplicity. That horse is out of the barn. That ship has sailed. That ship probably sailed with the horse on it. Like it's gone, whatever, however we want to explore that. But we start to wonder about a unifying force or a unifying principle or some way of having this diversity and wonder that we're encountering in our explorations in the disorder box. We're starting to feel like, is there a way to pull that together that might make the world a better place for everyone? And you could say we're looking for a new kind of space. We value those experiences of taking things apart and examining them, of exploring what we believe, but we're looking for a new kind of space. And we're gonna call that space, today we're gonna call that space reorder. All right, this one. Now, here's an important aspect of this metaphor. And you can see the challenge right away. It doesn't matter how we come at this. As soon as we kind of make it concrete, make it stages, make it boxes, however we do it, we go kind of one, two, three. Order, disorder, reorder. A, B, C. Start here, go there. Sequence, right? It's important, despite that sort of obvious tilt to all of this, it's important not to think of our journey as boxes in succession. I know this is challenging. It's not that we climb out of one box and into the next. It's more like the bigger boxes contain the smaller boxes. It's more like, you know, that Russian doll thing? You know, where the dolls are inside one another? It's more like that. It's more like the boxes are inside one another. Right? So that can kind of help us imagine that when we move out of one box and into the next box, the stuff from the previous box is still there. We're not abandoning the box. We're not shoving it off the edge of the table and going, bye-bye. It's part of our experience. We're moving from one box into the next box, into the next box. And that's hard to see as we go, because when we're in the littlest box, we think that that's all there is. And when we break out of that box and into the middle box, we have that same experience. We think that middle box of disorder, in this particular illustration, we think that's all there is. And then the same thing when we come to the reorder box. This is the ultimate box. I'm in the big box now. I've arrived. Remember we talked a little bit about
about hope and how hope is the fuel and the engine that kind of, you know, keeps us going. The key to moving forward with hope is the understanding that all of our boxes exist within a much larger mystery, which we've been using the word love for. Now, if God and love are synonyms for you, then we could also use the word God for that mystery. The point is this. However we name it, we can name it universe, love, God, whatever kind of language handles, whatever kind of language symbols we make for that mystery, it is always bigger than our biggest box. And that's the end we need to have in mind from the beginning. An end that has no end. If that's too, you know, woo-woo for you, try this. Think about the box within a box image, but imagine that the big box has no lid. Even after we create in our life experience this reorder box, if that's how our journey unfolds and that's the box we end up in, we will still encounter some idea or some experience or some data that this reorder box cannot contain. Some days, maybe the last year and a half has felt like this to some of us, some days that can feel like it's happening to us like every other day. You know, we're just getting smacked with things that don't fit in our box. So the way we make meaning of the world, the way we make sense of the world as humans, we seem to need boxes. That's partly how we can manage to get our minds around this stuff. But if we keep it in mind that our goal from the beginning is love, not being loving, but becoming love, then we're more likely to remember to keep the lids off the boxes so we can move through them and hit their limits and just keep on going instead of losing hope, feeling stuck, and giving up. That's the place we don't want to end up, is stuck and giving up short of the end goal of love. All right, that's all I'm going to say about, you know, these ideas and these images today. But I hope that can be a helpful metaphor to keep in mind, that order, disorder, reorder is a meaningful way to understand growing and changing spiritually. And it can be filled with hope, especially if we understand that no matter what kind of box we make, in the end, all of these lived experiences are happening within a mystery that is boundless, inside a space that is not a space, if you will, a space that is lidless and open. And in fact, in our sort of understanding of the material universe, if we want to return to a physical illustration, is expanding outward all the time. What a thought. So much of what we've been considering today has been inspired by the thoughtful work and writing of Richard Rohr. And so to wrap this up, I'm going to give Richard Rohr the last word. If Richard was here, there would be two things I think he would say. One is he would probably remind us that there is no direct flight from order to reorder. You can't skip disorder in this metaphor. And we can't seem to skip disorder in our growth and change. And that's where doubt comes in, right? Doubt is the catalyst for disorder. Doubt tosses things up in the air. And things being up in the air is what moves us into a space where we can grow and change, where we can move to the next box, where we can come closer to having the capacity to understand that that everything we're experiencing needs some boundarying because of who we are, because of our limitations, but not because of the limitations of love or God. That's expanding outward. So he would want to remind us there's no direct flight is a phrase that I know he enjoys using for that reality of our experiences. And I think this quote from Rohr might sum it all up beautifully. So in the words of Richard Rohr, love is the source and goal. Faith is the slow process of getting there. And hope is the willingness to move forward without resolution or closure. And then he goes on to say, and these are indeed the three things that last, a phrase from 1 Corinthians 13. People who have these gifts, faith, hope, and love, are indestructible. We could also say unstoppable in this process of change and growth and and experiencing doubt and having doubt be catalytic in that change and growth, right? All right, that's where we're going to leave it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for exploring together. I would hate to do this alone. Many people do. And I feel incredibly fortunate to be part of a community where we can do this together.